If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're at the first annual Southwest Love Fest in Tucson, Arizona, speaking with lawyer Jonathan Lane, who specializes in family law for the polyamorous, kinky, and LGBTQ communities. So, first of all, we're here at Southwest Love Fest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So happy to be in Tucson.
Yeah.
I'm so sweaty to be in Tucson.
Yes.
It is a warm place to be.
It's indeed true. It is.
But we've been having a great time. We've given one of our talks so far, and we're doing another one tomorrow about relationship anarchy, which
should
be exciting.
Met a lot of Multiamory fans, which has been
really
sweet.
Yeah, thank you, everyone.
Actually, yes. Right before we recorded this, a Multiamory fan bought us a bunch of drinks in the bar.
Yes. And by a bunch of drinks, she means one round of drinks.
They bought us a round of drinks.
Yes.
This individual bought many drinks.
That's true.
For each
yes,
of us.
That's so. True.
Yes. And also for like Dr. Elizabeth Sheff
right.
and Ruby Johnson's here.
Yes.
And, like there's a bunch of people here who've either been on our show before, like Kevin Patterson's mm-hmm. here. So it's really cool to get to see all these people, many of whom we haven't seen in person before.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Big honor. So glad to be here.
Yeah.
And with that, let's get into it.
Let's get into this. So in this episode, we're talking about, you know, advice from a lawyer. We did this a while ago with Diana Adams, talking mostly about family law.
Mostly
we're going to talk about
custody as well.
Mostly custody. And so we're going to talk about some other nuances that have to do with marriage and family law, things like immigration, different ways that divorces can go, legal, like getting fired from jobs, stuff like that, which is really cool. So you want to get into it?
Let's do it.
Okay, we are here at our hotel room at the Southwest Love Fest in Tucson, Arizona, and we have invited Jonathan Lane to come to our hotel room with us, not for anything
awesome
sketchy.
Presentation. No, he had
not
an awesome presentation himself.
But to talk to us. So Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit more about who you are and what it is that you do?
Well, I'm an attorney at J.D. Lane Law, and my practice focuses primarily on family law, including divorce, child custody, protections for non-traditional families, and changes of name and gender. My practice emphasizes sexually diverse communities, including the polyamorous, kinky, and LGBTQ. I'm licensed in the District of Columbia and Maryland, and I have an inactive license in California.
Got it.
Okay, because you're from California?
I am actually
from
Tucson.
Oh,
like
right.
Me, we are the same.
You're the same
way.
Person.
In that way.
Okay, great.
How long have you been practicing law within the polyamorous community?
It's been about a year and a half since I decided that there was this need. Basically, most of these issues are issues of state law, and you basically need a lawyer who is licensed in your state.
Mm-hmm.
Diana Adams is the pioneer of this field, but she's only licensed in New York.
Right.
And so, you're the up-and-coming Diana Adams, so it's
you're
okay.
You're the next Diana Adams.
Yeah, you're the next generation of Diana.
That is quite a compliment. we'll see.
Uh-huh. So, basically, to let our listeners in, the way that this episode came to be is that we all, after we finished our presentations, we all went out for a drink in the hotel, we all sat down and started talking about the stuff that Jonathan does. And Jonathan, you mentioned specifically that you also work particularly in immigration cases and how they relate to like polyamory. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work doing that?
Yes. So I have a background in immigration law, actually from working with special immigrant juveniles from Central America.
Oh, wow.
And so I started doing those cases pro bono 6 or 7 years ago. And I've worked with about 7 children on those cases. And so when I realized that there was a need for the legal services and among the polyamorous, that included immigration. I was getting questions about immigration. So There's a couple different big areas. The first is that the distinction between polyamory and polygamy is very important in the immigration context.
Do people not automatically know the difference between those two things just when you get into a legal situation or in front of a judge?
Well, I think a lot of times people hear that if you're a polygamist, then you can't become a U.S. citizen, and they worry, oh, if I'm poly, does that mean that I'm not going to be able to become a U.S. citizen? Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'm actually going to put a pin in that really quick, because that was something we want to talk about more, because I had no idea that if you are polygamous or if you're married to multiple people, then you're barred from becoming a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, so can you tell us what's the detail of that?
What's like, the deal?
It's part of the laws and regulations of who can become a citizen of the United States are that you have to have good moral character. And it was decided at some point that being a polygamist means that you, by definition, do not have good moral character.
If you have multiple spouses.
Well, I wonder if that was, I think it was turn of the century when a lot of like the bigamy, or it was earlier than the turn of the century when a lot of the bigamy laws were getting on the books. That was like part of a big pushback against like what the Mormons were doing and things like that. I wonder if that was a product of that time as well, of kind of deciding that, you know, we don't want to let anyone in who is promoting what we see as bigamy, essentially.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, basically, all U.S. immigration law comes from 1924 to the present. Before that, there was like the Chinese Exclusion Act and stuff like that, but most people could just show up.
Right, wow. Which is how most of our families got here.
We
just did those DNA tests, like, so we've been talking about
23andMe and Ancestry.com.
Yeah, right. I see. Okay, so that's on the books that like if you're polygamous, which I think is obviously something that comes up mostly if you're coming from a predominantly Muslim country or culture where, you know, having multiple wives maybe is more acceptable. So if that's on the books that you can't become a citizen if you're practicing polygamy or in some way. But it seems like in your situation that you're getting clients who are polyamorous and maybe someone who's immigrating is marrying someone who's a U.S. citizen and they both have, you know, a consensually non-monogamous relationship, that there is the concern of like, is this going to have any repercussions?
Like,
Will it disqualify me for being able to immigrate essentially through marriage?
Exactly. And the short answer to that is no.
Great.
Well done.
It's always worth consulting with an immigration attorney for your particular situation. And the government does do an investigation into the marriages of people who claim immigration benefits on the basis of marriage. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure that this is a legitimate romantic relationship and this isn't something that is being done just as a pretext to get that immigration benefit. So the government will, an employee of the government will ask a lot of questions. They may take affidavits where people say, I know these people and, you know, this is where I've seen them socially and this is sort of the context of their relationship and sort of vouching. You can also, you know, show evidence of pictures and lots of examples of things that when you are in a romantic relationship with someone, you accumulate a lot of evidence of the time you've spent together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely helps to have a lawyer who knows something about polyamory, because if you don't, then that might be a really big challenge for the people who are trying to like have immigrate or become immigrants of this country.
Exactly. A lot of people don't know what polyamory is, and they may just get scared away. Immigration lawyers obviously know about this polygamy thing, and they may just get freaked out, like, oh, this is going to be a big problem, or really concerned, but it shouldn't be. You just have to be careful as you navigate the process in terms of how you present yourself in your relationship.
Well, when you talk about that, about being careful when navigating the process, like, I mean, what's kind of, what can you practically like advise people to do? Because like, what counts as careful? Is careful like, you know, continue to practice multiple relationships but make sure that you erase all evidence of ever being with any other partner on social media? Or like, is that okay? It's just that the government wants to focus on making sure that this particular marriage is valid. Like, what are the things that people can or can't do if they're trying to mitigate the risk of of, you know, not being able to immigrate.
Well, you don't want to advertise that you're having sex with other people, because that will, you know, raise some concerns for a person from the government. But that isn't really their business. They're really there to figure out if your relationship is legitimate. And similarly, on Facebook, it's not common for people to say on Facebook, this is someone who I'm having sex with. You know, look at this picture of us. It's just, you know, so here's someone I'm spending time with, and here's a picture, and here's a picture of me with someone else I'm spending time with. And, you know, those people, one of them could be a spouse or a prospective spouse. Mm-hmm. One could just be a friend. It doesn't really matter.
It's kind of about passing.
Right. I mean, basically, you want clear evidence that you have this substantial relationship with another person.
Right.
If you didn't have pictures with the person that you married or are planning to marry, and you had lots of pictures with another partner, that would stand out and be really weird.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if you have pictures with one person who is the person that you've married or are going to marry, and pictures with another person who happens to be a partner, they could just as easily be a close friend.
Well, here's my question, though, because I always...
Yeah, I have a question, too.
I try to think about it for my own life, right? You know, I mm-hmm. think about, like, okay, so if I married somebody in order to immigrate or whatever, and, like, my personal life, obviously this isn't applicable to everyone, but my personal life is, like, on my Instagram, I post specifically, oh, I'm celebrating my anniversary with this particular partner, yeah. And then 2 months later, oh, I'm celebrating my anniversary with this particular partner. I know there's some people who are polyamorous who are, like, fine to post, like, kissy pictures with multiple partners. And so when it starts getting beyond that, like there's, you know, like it could be a friend, could be a close friend, we don't know. Like when it gets beyond that point, like is that something that people should avoid doing? Or is that something that technically, even though that's happening, the government can't do anything because it's really not their business as long as this particular relationship is valid? Sorry, I keep trying to like make it more complicated, but...
Well, I'd say that it's worth being careful, and so you don't want to put things that really encourage those questions, because the more that someone from the government notices something and they're asking questions, even if it may come to nothing, it'll just cause you problems and cause you stress.
Right.
And so if you are in that particular situation, then I would probably be careful about overtly sexual or romantic photos with other partners.
I see.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that was supposedly mine about just posting, you know, hashtag boyfriend, hashtag girlfriend, that sort of stuff. And it sounds like it'd be sort of the similar answer of, I guess it's just hard to say. And I guess, tell me if I'm right here, but what I'm getting from you is that there isn't really a hard and fast, and it's not like they see something like that and automatically you're disqualified because it's not illegal to do, but that it's more you just don't want them to ask more questions than they need to, or like you don't want them to have anything to doubt.
Exactly. If they are looking into social media accounts, you want it to be reasonably straightforward.
Right.
And having photos with multiple people is normal.
Right. Yeah. But okay. All right. I mean, I think I get a sense for that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we want to move on to the next thing, which you talked about in your presentation, which is about prenups for marriage. So I guess what we were wondering about is like, what are specific tips for people who are getting married, but who are polyamorous or in some other kind of non-monogamous relationship? Like, what are some things that a normal like prenup lawyer might not even think of or things like that, right?
Well, probably the best example of that is issues related to the maintenance of monogamy. Sometimes prenups will... So prenups mostly focus on finances,
right,
in the case of a divorce. And sometimes they say, if there is a divorce, and if there's a certain cause, or if X happened, then you get this certain amount of money, mm-hmm. and so on. And sometimes that can be related to sex. and like infidelity.
Right.
So, you know, if this person has some sexual contact outside of the marriage, then therefore they are responsible for a certain additional amount of money, like a penalty.
Gosh, I can't even imagine having that conversation. Is it standard in a prenup to include like an infidelity clause?
I mean, it makes sense because it's probably a reason for people to be
divorced. Get it, but I mean, yeah. Is that like everyone does that, or
it's not routine, but it certainly is something that happens.
Oh,
a lot of the prenups are really, it's up to the people who are preparing them and the couple to sort of decide what arrangements they want. And basically, as long as they have made proper disclosures and everyone is properly represented, then it should hold up.
That's just so fascinating to me. Like, I'm very pro prenup personally. I mean, I'm not married and I'm not planning on getting married, but I'm very pro prenup. And I know some people think it's like very non-romantic or like a little bit too, I don't know.
It's pragmatic.
It's very pragmatic. Yeah. Maybe too pragmatic according to some people.
Yeah.
I just can't even imagine having that conversation where you're trying to figure out what's the dollar amount assigned to you cheating
on me. How much is an affair worth?
How much is an affair worth?
You're a fair worth. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Jeez. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, the thing that I think about prenups and the possible perverse incentives is divorce sucks.
Mm-hmm.
It's very traumatic. And you have to be really motivated to get a divorce. And the idea that having worked out these financial things in advance is going to make you go ahead and divorce, you're probably going to do it anyways.
Mm. Like if you're at the point where you're going to get divorced, you're just going to do it anyway, whether you have a prenup or not.
The marginal case where you wouldn't get divorced except that you already have this prenup that makes it much similar. It doesn't actually make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
That's true.
Yeah.
I guess that's true.
Well, speaking of divorce, you talked about divorce in your talk today, and specifically like dissolving marriages and handling divorce. But how do you do that within consensually non-monogamous couples? And what does like divorce look like? You talked about like four different ways in which things can kind of pan out.
Exactly. So there are four different ways that you can proceed with divorce. First two are relatively obvious. One is you don't hire a lawyer, just the two people agree on all the issues, and then they just file things with the court to make that legally binding.
And is that like, is there like a checklist of all the things you have to agree on, or do you just have to kind of come up with it yourself?
Like, we're divorced now.
there are basic forms that are available in probably every state.
To figure out like how you're going to split up everything,
your assets and all that. Like that.
Yes. So there, as you know, millions of people get divorced each year, and a high percentage of them don't have lawyers, and a lot of them don't have significant assets. Sometimes, actually, you're dealing with how to split up their debts.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
See, the media would tell you otherwise. I'm like, oh, everyone who gets divorced has a lawyer.
It does seem that way.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
They also tell you that everyone who's getting married, that the average wedding is $30,000.
Yeah.
Right.
And clearly, when the median income is, you know, 50 something thousand a year, for people, you know, a marrying age, that's not actually the median of what people spend.
Yeah,
that is actually, sorry, I want to kind of jump on that because that is so funny about how the media distorts your perception of it. Because yeah,
like
I was just having a conversation,
Kramer versus Kramer.
Yes,
and
I was just having
like
a conversation with my sister actually about the cost of her wedding dress, and she told me what it was, and I was like, "What? It was that cheap?" And she was like, "Oh, that was kind of expensive." And I was like, "Because the media thinks it makes me think that everyone spends $5,000 on their wedding dress,
yeah.
You know?"
Yeah.
Or at least a couple grand. Like, that was what I thought. I thought everyone budgeted a couple of grand.
My wife spent about $1,000, and I winced a little bit.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway, sorry.
What did she spend on the dress?
I don't know if she wants
it. Okay, all right, sorry.
Not thousands of dollars, but it's a beautiful dress. But this is not what this podcast is about, so let's get
back to that. Speaks about wedding dresses.
So sorry, that was the one. You're going through a list of four.
Yes. So as I was saying, doing it yourself can make sense when partners have similar earnings and limited assets and there's no kids. And then it can work, and it certainly saves some money. And I've had clients who I've worked with who were going about that process and just had a few questions about just how to make it run smoothly, and I just worked with them just very briefly on that. So the other extreme is for each party to hire a lawyer and for each of those lawyers to prepare to go to court to have those issues decided by a judge through a trial. Usually along the way, there's a settlement, but there are a lot of legal fees typically up, yeah, even if you don't get to an actual trial.
Right.
And there's a lot of reasons to try to avoid the trial process if you can. And poly people are even more unlikely than others to want a judge to be making judgments about their marriage.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, and I actually am really encouraged to hear about the really simple version of doing this, because we've encountered a number of people who identify as polyamorous, who are married, who maybe decide they don't want to be married anymore, not that that's the end of the relationship. Like, they still want to be in a relationship together. It's just that, like, they don't want legal marriage anymore, or maybe they want to be able to legally marry someone else in order for someone to have health insurance or for different parenting rights or whatever.
Or immigration, like we were talking about.
Right. And so, but I think that I've seen a lot of people who are like, well, we think that we want to dissolve our marriage, but all that we see in the media is like these horrible long divorce proceedings that seem awful, when it's like, we just kind of want to just be able to kind of split this up so just that we can kind of restructure our relationship in a little bit of a different way. So it is really
the way
nice
that we want.
To hear about that. But that also does make sense that if it is kind of looking more like a traditional divorce, that having a possibly more traditional judge be the one deciding what the value is of what in your relationship, in your very non-traditional relationship, that maybe some people wouldn't really want to go through that.
And it sounds like that's on like one end, one extreme, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So those are the extremes in terms of how complicated it is and how expensive it is.
Right.
So then there's two other things that are kind of in between those two. One is mediation, in which a neutral mediator works with both parties to identify the relevant issues and talk through those issues and then work to come to an agreement on those issues. Obviously, this is not easy, but it does usually work. And I'm a trained divorce mediator. Not all mediators are lawyers. There are some excellent mediators who are not lawyers. But if you work with a mediator who is a lawyer, that person can then write up the agreement between the parties as a contract, which then can be basically submitted to the judge with the paperwork.
So it sounds like this option's kind of like option number one, where you settle it yourselves. You're just kind of having someone help you do that, right? Like kind of guiding you through that process.
Well, in a way, yes, you're coming to a settlement. And really, and the last option that I'll cover is a sort of another way of reaching a settlement. And that's the collaborative process, which is a voluntary dispute resolution process in which you settle without resort to litigation. But each side has a lawyer.
Hmm.
So it's a very different dynamic to be working with as a lawyer. It's much more cooperative, but each lawyer is working for the client's best interest. The way it works is that basically all the information that's relevant and like should be part of the decision-making about how money should get settled or what should happen with child custody if that's an issue, all that information is voluntarily disclosed. And then the parties agree to use good faith efforts in their negotiation to reach a settlement, like you would in a mediation.
Mm-hmm.
But each party has a lawyer. And the interesting thing about this process is that when you start this process, you sign an agreement that says, if you leave the process and file a lawsuit, then your lawyer will no longer be your lawyer.
You have to get a different lawyer
to represent you in the lawsuit, which it changes the dynamics.
Yeah, sure. Totally.
Because you have a lawyer who's really just working on a settlement and you're motivated for a settlement. Divorce trials can make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So,
it like helps to make sure your lawyer isn't trying to
reverse incentive. With this way, keeping things in the process, it encourages both the client and the lawyer to do whatever they can to come to an agreement.
I see.
Right.
I see. That makes sense.
I should note that the process also has opportunities to involve mental health and financial professionals, because divorce is not just a legal proceeding, but it's an emotional proceeding and a financial proceeding.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on AdamMail.com and EvesToys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love AdamandEve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to AdamandEve.com, AdamMail.com, or EvesToys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, M-U-L-T-I, at AdamandEve.com, AdamMail.com, or EvesToys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code M-U-L-T-I. So you were telling us a story a little bit earlier about handling a divorce for a couple that was consensually non-monogamous, but it was more of a traditional divorce, like they weren't going to be in a relationship with each other, but they were consensually non-monogamous, and that was something that you had to disclose to the other lawyer?
Yes, so what happened is I knew that my client was poly and that they'd been poly throughout their relationship. I don't think it had come up with the other side and his lawyer. And so the other lawyer sent me a set of questions called interrogatories that within 30 days we had to respond to. Typed out, these are our answers to these questions, sworn under oath. Most of them were things about money. Things like, what are your credit card accounts, and what are the balances, and what are your checking accounts, and all this financial stuff. But then towards the end, there was the following. State whether you have had sexual relationships with any person other than your spouse since the date of your marriage to your spouse. And if so, state the names, addresses, and telephone numbers of each such persons, the date of sexual relations, and the place of sexual relations.
Jeez.
So here's my 50-page document.
Yeah, here's my big dossier.
Like I wrote it in my diary every single time it happened. Yikes.
It just doesn't make any sense in a poly context. And you have to respond under oath to these questions. And this is actually not that unusual a question. I think this is probably
it
one that
so
this
weird
lawyer...
To us.
This is a very experienced lawyer on the other side, and he probably puts that in for every case. And so you can imagine that having this question could create some awkward conversations between an attorney and a client.
Right.
But in my case, I knew that the client was poly and was comfortable with that. So I had no hesitation objecting the question. And I wrote back that they were consensually non-monogamous throughout their marriage. And therefore, the details of any sexual relations with other persons is not relevant to this case.
And then that was, fine. And that was
so far.
So far, okay.
So they just kind of dropped it.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I can't even imagine, like, if I was someone who was poly and I'm trying to go through a divorce, and I just hire a lawyer who's not familiar with what's going on, and then suddenly having to field that question. You know, like, I imagine much being much more difficult in that scenario.
You may not even be thinking about poly and, when you're, poly is not generally the reason that people are divorcing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so people don't even think that it's going to be relevant. Mm-hmm. And so then someone says, hey, list everyone that you've had sex with and where you've had sex with them and when you had sex with them. It's really out of left field.
It's ridiculous.
And not a question that most people expect to have with their lawyer.
Right.
Yeah, seriously, I could see that being a very awkward conversation.
Yeah, gosh, my goodness.
Wow.
So we're going to turn the corner a little bit here away from just talking about marriage and divorce. And we were curious about what have you seen any progress at all as far as securing any kind of employment protections for polyamorous people or people who are in non-traditional relationships?
So there's an early movement to start trying to get protections at the city level in cities around the country. And there's some efforts in California as well as on the East Coast to start to try to lobby city councils to add non-monogamy to the categories that they protect. That basically you can't be fired for that reason.
Just within like the city jurisdiction.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly. We're not at the point where any states have tackled it. We're just at the point where first few cities looking into it. Maybe in 5 years, if we have 50 cities that have done it, maybe we'll get some states that'll do it. Mm. I'd certainly imagine in many states, it's still legal to fire someone for being gay.
Right.
Is that still? I thought that. So that's, I was under the impression that was a federal protection, but that's just on the state level.
So there has not been a federal protection passed.
Wow.
And so it's a matter of state law.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that. That's really good to know.
Now we know that. Now everyone knows that.
Yes.
And we got to change that.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Right.
Wow, interesting. That is good for people to know, though, of like starting on this city level that maybe seems a little bit less intimidating mm-hmm. than, because I feel like when these discussions come up about, you know, marriage rights for people who are non-monogamous or employment rights or child custody rights, I think everyone immediately goes to like, how do we get this to the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
You know, which just feels like such a huge task. But I think the idea of knowing that like this can start at the city level and that's how we can kind of get these things to snowball is actually, I think, encouraging.
Yeah.
A little daunting, but also encouraging.
Absolutely. I think a lot of cities, 2 or 3 years down the line, there can be a movement. And maybe we'll have cities around the country that start to have those protections.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
At the moment, I don't know how much you know about this. I know you work mostly in family law, but I mean, is there anything that someone can do if they were fired because their boss found out they were polyamorous and thought that was gross and fired them? Or are you pretty much SOL at this point?
Well, for most people in most jobs in most states, employment is at will, which basically as long as there are not a few specifically listed things that are the reasons why you were fired, then you can be fired. And so, you know, being fired on the basis of race and gender are obviously examples of those. And in some states and some cities, being gay is also included in that. Being polyamorous is something that could be added to that, but it hasn't been.
Mm. Right.
Sexual orientation has been defined as being gay, straight, or bisexual.
Right. So, have you found that there are a lot of, like, have a lot of cases come through your office related to that? Or is this, because I know a lot of people worry about it, they worry about coming out as being polyamorous for fear of losing their job or, you know, some other repercussions like that. Yeah, like, just in your personal experience, have you seen that there's a lot of that? Or do people maybe worry about that more than, like, more than it actually happens?
So I had one case where someone wanted to talk to me about that they were hearing from their employer that they were probably going to be let go. And it was not related to poly, but to kink. And there were some other, there were some other additional issues, but basically there wasn't much that could be done.
Mm.
Everyone's situation is different, but most people shouldn't freak out about the risk. The risk is still probably quite low. Consider how many people are non-monogamous in an unethical framework, and how rare it is to have any work consequences from that. I I just did a brief consultation with this person. It was sort of on an emergency basis,
right?
Because they needed to know, and I didn't know of a poly-friendly employment lawyer who I could get them in touch with quickly. So,
so if you out there listening are an employment lawyer who's poly-friendly, get in touch.
Let us
we'll
know.
Connect you guys
for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, got it. Let's move on to a slightly happier topic here, which is you were telling us about a case that you worked on recently in Maryland about actually getting parenting rights for three parents.
Yes. So this is one of a number of cases that have been happening around the country. This isn't the sort of case that you'll see articles written about, because this was something where we were actually able to come to a settlement before there was actually even a trial. But basically, this case involved two women who were in a relationship with each other, and one of the women had sex with a man and got pregnant. The two women decided to raise the child together. The women ended up splitting up, and then they were living apart but sharing custody of the child. Then the father came back into the picture and first got, you know, every other weekend custody, but then decided to seek full custody of the child in a suit against the biological mother.
Wow.
So my client was the person who this child was spending most of the time with. Basically, at the point that this started, it was 5 days a week the child was living with her.
But, and she was the non-biological mother.
Exactly. She was a non-biological mother.
Right.
And so she wasn't the legal parent. She wasn't the biological parent. She wasn't an adoptive parent. You basically can't do an adoption when there's two existing parents.
Hmm.
Unless someone agrees to completely give up their parental rights.
Right.
So, fortunately, in 2016, Maryland, where this case was, adopted a doctrine called de facto parenthood, which is something that's been done in a number of states. And
yeah, I think California has adopted that. Is that right?
Something similar.
Something, because I thought there was a similar case in California.
I was looking at a map a couple days ago, and so there are gradations in terms of the level of protections for de facto parents.
Mm-hmm.
And California was not on the highest level, but it was not on the lowest level. I don't know the detail for California. But in Maryland, they got a really strong decision. And so a former live-in partner who meets the four criteria would be able to seek custody or visitation on an equal playing field with the biological or adoptive parent.
Wow. Mm,
wow.
So those four things are that the biological or adoptive parent consented to and encouraged the petitioner's formation and establishment of a parent-like relationship with the child.
Huh.
Two, that the petitioner and the child lived together in the same household. Three, that the petitioner assumed obligations of parenthood by taking significant responsibility for the child's care, education, and development, including financial responsibility. And four, that the petitioner has been in a parental role for long enough to develop a, quote, bonded, dependent relationship, parental in nature.
Hmm.
So if over the course of basically years, this person is treated as a parent by the legal parent, and they're living in the house, and they're contributing towards the child's well-being and basically being a parent, then they can contest for custody on an equal ground, and then it's a matter of what's in the best interest of the child.
I see.
That's versus normally someone who's not a biological or adoptive parent who wants to get custody of a child would need to show that the other parent is unfit.
I see.
Which is tough to do,
right?
So this gave my client then sort of that equal standing.
Mm.
Then when we went into court, we were able to establish that my client qualifies as a de facto parent.
Mm.
And basically, once we got that, then we were able to work with the two biological parents to get a settlement that basically got everything that we were looking for. Mm-hmm. And my client is now recognized as a legal parent. And she has joint physical custody and joint legal custody.
Wow.
That's of this great. Child.
Wow.
Yeah,
so with amazing. States that do incorporate the de facto parenting thing, I mean, is this something that, let's say it's not a situation where there's, you know, the biological parents splitting up, you know, kind of the situation that the case was, but as in three people who come together and decide we want to raise a child together, is there a way for them to proactively kind of get these parenting rights granted or not, or is there not really a precedent for that yet?
It's not very developed yet. Mm-hmm. This all this sort of three parent stuff is sort of cutting
edge.
It's
been kind
of
a little bit reactionary to a certain extent.
Right. These fact patterns are coming up and judges are starting to be more receptive to the idea that maybe having three parental figures is okay. Mm-hmm. And maybe their rights can be protected.
Right. Huh.
Yeah. I mean, it's great that we've also, you know, there have been a number of talks today about either people's personal stories or like Dr. Elizabeth Sheff's research about polyamorous families. And hopefully as there's more and more of those sorts of longitudinal studies showing the well-being of children with multiple parents, that hopefully more judges and more lawmakers would start to come around to that.
Absolutely.
I don't know how far off that's going to be, but
it is probably a bit. I just, where my brain goes to is, it seems like a big part of the de facto parent thing is that you already have to have these years of time to prove like the child has spent a lot of the child's time with this parent. This parent's been driving the kid to school, has been getting him to the doctor and whatever, but that in the case of like three people who just decide they want to have a baby together, they don't necessarily have that body of evidence there, you know, to prove that that this third person is a de facto parent. That seems like that would be
that
the issue.
Some time
there
would have to go by without those protections first.
Yeah. Right. So basically, it's important to keep in mind that when you have people who are agreeing with each other, they can divide the parental responsibilities however they want.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is only something that comes into play when there's a dispute.
Right.
But this example here of getting these parental protections, do these also then apply to things like, you know, like hospital visits or some of the classic examples used where family members and parents have more, you know, have more rights than, you know, your mom's boyfriend does or your mom's girlfriend does, something like that? Does it also apply to that, or is this really only about custody and about having an equal, you know, equal playing field in terms of fighting for that?
Well, so there's two parts of custody. There's physical custody and legal custody. Physical custody,
what's the difference?
Is where the child spends time, you know, and who is with the child. You know, every other weekend with his parent, or, you know, 1 week with his parent, 1 week with the other parent, that's physical custody.
Got it.
Legal custody is about decision making, mostly about healthcare, education, and religion.
Like who can sign?
And who decides where, what child, excuse me, what school the child goes to.
Right.
Who decides if the child gets particular medical care or dental care.
Right.
If the child is raised in a particular religious faith, those are sort of the classic parental decision making that's part of legal custody.
Right.
I see. And so in this example in Maryland, is this both legal and physical then, you said?
Yes.
That's
yes,
cool.
The client got both. And so actually the legal custody was granted to the three parents collectively.
Wow.
And so in theory, when any major decision has to be made in those areas, the three of them have to talk and come to an agreement.
That's great.
Well, best of luck to them on that.
I know. So if something happens and you're in need of an attorney and you're polyamorous, how do you find an attorney that is poly-friendly?
So,
other than you and Diana Adams.
Exactly.
Basically.
Right. Go to the two of you first. And then, but if you're out of the state of Maryland or New York.
Right. So there's a great list, Polyfriendly Professionals. It's a website. can look up, and there are poly-friendly attorneys in probably 15 or 20 states who are listed.
Right.
Okay.
If someone is hearing this and you are an attorney and you are poly-friendly and you are not on that list,
get on it.
Yeah.
Get on that list.
Yeah.
Is that, are you, so just to clarify, are you talking about the poly-friendly professionals list that's run through like the NCSF? The
So NCSF does mm-hmm. the kink aware
right,
professionals.
Okay, because I'm in that directory, yeah.
And there's a separate poly-friendly professionals
Got it. Got
maintained it. By the same people, or is it a totally
it's
separate thing?
It's maintained by a different organization.
Okay.
Is that something where people just Google poly-friendly professionals,
yes.
they'll find it?
Yes. Okay. You nice. Just type in poly-friendly professionals, and you will find it. And
great.
You can search by what kind of professional, mm-hmm. and by state.
Lovely. Okay.
Which
excellent.
Is particularly important in legal context.
Of course. Yeah. Yes. Of course.
For yeah. most of these things, it totally
all
depends
state
on state.
Based. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Wow, I feel like we covered a lot of ground.
We did, a ton.
I know. Is there anything else that you feel like we haven't covered today that you would really, you feel like our listeners at home would be able to benefit from? I feel like we've covered so much.
Uh-huh. I think it's good for now. Maybe I'll come back next year and we'll see what else yeah. I have for you.
We'll come back to Southwest Love Fest again.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot more
so
information for us.
Specifically, where can our listeners find out more about you and the work that you do?
So you can find my website for J.D. Lane Law at www.jdlanelaw.com, and you will find all my contact information on there.
Okay.
Great.
Awesome.
Yay.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
I feel like I learned so much today.
I seriously, yes. yeah. I feel like yeah. I had a little, like, Law 100 for non-majors.
Yeah,
class.
Exactly. It was great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you would like to have your question or comment played on the show, you can call our number at 678-MULTI-05 and leave a voicemail, or you can send us an audio message at the MultiAmory Facebook page. You can also email us at info@multiamory.com or send us a message on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. To support our show and join our private Facebook community, go to patreon.com/multiamory. MultiAmory is created and produced by Dedeker Winston, Emily Matlack, and me, Jace Lindgren. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.